Well, death is tragic. There's just really nothing good about death itself. It interrupts relationships mid-flow. And some of you should be up the front here, not me, because you can speak of this in ways far deeper than I can. You know it from the inside out. Plans get set aside. It's violent in its nature, even if it's not a violent death, just in how it happens so tragically and suddenly. It just hurts very deeply when it happens. And platitudes just aren't helpful, are they, in those moments? You know the sorts of things that might get said. You'll get over it. You don't get over that grief like that, do you? Some of you are shaking your head, and I know you know it. It's time you moved on. Grief has its own time schedule. Those sort of statements just don't recognize the depth of loss that's been experienced, the connection that you've had that has suddenly gone. And that loss is terrible. This is not a message just for old people facing death. A young couple this week, lady lost her life in a shark attack, car accident, you name it. It's something that everyone has on their doorstep that we need to address and be ready for. But here's what I need to say in my most unministerly way. Death sucks. And Jesus thought so too. And one of the ways I know that is from John 11. What I find so helpful and heartwarming about our passage today is that we get an inside look at God's perspective on death. And we get to see that he finds death tragic too. And that tells me that we're not alone in our suffering, in all of that grief and loss that we feel. We are not alone. And it's strange because the Bible tells us that death is the wages of sin, that justice that is played out in death. But that doesn't mean that God's compassion isn't evident in that space as well. He takes no pleasure in that death. And he also doesn't stand distant from us. In our passage today, Jacob raised this for us. Jesus weeps at death, which tells me that death isn't okay. It's not okay. And at a funeral service, the hope we have isn't because we're not fussed by death. Death is a tragedy. It's a terrible blight on human experience. But Jesus helps us see that God is larger than the trauma and suffering and hopelessness we feel and has overcome our circumstances in powerful ways. And in all of the difficulty of grief and the loneliness and the darkness that death surrounds us with, I really find that to be a comforting thought. Now, Lazarus' death comes early in our passage. In verse 3, Jesus is told, "The one you love is sick." And by verse 17, we find that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days already. And it's Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, women that Jesus knows well, who send him the message about his sickness. Take note of that. This isn't just someone out there in the community that Jesus doesn't know in some way. Whole conversation about Jesus knowing everyone. He's well connected with the people this affects. And Jesus moves in this space in a manner that's assured of right ends in what's about to take place. He says, verse 4, "This sickness will not end in death." Well, that's a strange statement when we know Lazarus dies in verse 17. He gives us a direction for how this trauma and tragedy will proceed in the case of Lazarus. He says it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified. It's a message we've actually heard before. You remember the case of the blind man? That Jesus said, This man, it wasn't because of his parents or anything that he did, but it was for God's glory that he was blind. And it seems that where people seem tragedy and wrong, Jesus sees opportunities for God's glory to shine in extraordinary ways. Now, I'm guessing, if you're grieving, that stings to hear that Lazarus found life again, but your loved one didn't. I'm guessing there's a little bit of a sting in this. But what if this narrative is a window? A window on the future so that we see that all tragedy and all trauma were opportunities for God's glory. For the glory of God's Son to shine so that those who give glory to the Son will know life once again. What if we saw the curtain opened on what the future holds? See, those words aren't just true for Lazarus. And the manner in which Jesus moves in this space of impending death is of someone who's not fazed by current circumstances. He's not stressed, he's not anxious, but he's in control and at peace with what will come. When he proposes setting out to Judea once more, his disciples are just anxious about what's to come. It's a place of hostility. It's where they tried to stone Jesus just a short time before. In verses 8 to 10, Jesus has some words about walking in the daylight instead of at night. It's like he's saying the night of his death is coming, but there's still daylight hours to do the work that's needed to be done in the time remaining. Thomas, good old Thomas, we'll get to saying rather darkly in verse 16, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." It's very stoic. It just sort of stands at odds in many ways. The path Jesus takes is dark to others, but Jesus isn't overcome by this. He is in control. He has this in hand. In verse 11, he talks about Lazarus' death as sleep, and in verse 14, he makes that really explicitly clear to his disciples that Lazarus is asleep. And in verse 14, he'll say the word dead. He'll tell them that Lazarus is dead. But Jesus says he will wake up from that death. And that's an arresting and an astonishing statement. You get the scene laid for extraordinary things. It's full of power, it's full of self-confidence, and it's full of purpose in the face of all of the payload of what death means to us. Jesus arrives at the scene of Lazarus' death. He comes a full 4 days after his death. Verse 17 tells us that. That feels a little bit uncomfortable. Why didn't Jesus rush? Why didn't he come in a timely way? Where was his care of those sisters in that time? Of Lazarus? Why didn't he go? You need to know that Jewish thought world held that a person's spirit lingered near their body for 3 days after the death. It's just a funny idea. It's in the Talmud. It's a really strange concept, but that was a popular thought in that time. So what Jesus is doing here is establishing that Lazarus is dead. He arrives there after that third day. There's no question Lazarus is dead. And Martha comes out to meet Jesus and she expresses her grief and I think something of the disappointment that Jesus wasn't there at the time she wanted. She still holds on to Jesus as the one who can make a difference in this situation. It's really interesting to hear her words. It's in verse 21. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Mary says a really similar thing in verse 33. If you'd been here, if you'd only been here. That's the sort of questions we face at death. If only, if only, if only. Where were you, God, when I needed you at that moment? If you'd been here, this wouldn't have happened. but you weren't. And that's on you. And yet, she still holds on to Jesus in faith. It's a tortured moment, isn't it? To Martha, Jesus says in verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Resurrection, life, finds its logos directly in Jesus. It is a huge statement. It's huge for Martha to deal with at a moment of grief. But it's what she's got as real and living hope to hold on to in that moment. It's a pretty bold reach towards someone so deep in their grief. But I reckon Martha was the stoic one who could summon faith responses even in those moments. Because she responds with these words, I believe. I mean, she's hurting. She's hurting. So hear the hurt behind her as she says these words. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. That's a seminal moment in the passage. That is a massive, massive moment. She's in her grief, but she's holding on to Jesus for dear life. It's a moment of interchange between Jesus and Martha of such significance. It's bold faith under pressure in the middle of grief and loss and all that that brings into your life. It's based on a past relationship with Jesus. She knows Jesus and she trusts in him. She knows who she's believing in and she trusts him implicitly even in this dark valley. And when Jesus and Mary meet and he hears her heartbroken words echoing Martha's feelings, when he sees her weeping, guess what he does? Well, you know. Shortest verse in the English Bible. He weeps. There's nothing dignified or dressed up about that statement. And I love it. It's the raw, hurting emotion of that moment shared between Jesus and his friends. He grieves too. See how he loved him, some say. Yes, that's right. See how he loved him. He really did love him. He loved Mary and Martha too. He cared. That's the point. He cares deeply. You don't weep for no reason. But for others, there's still questions. Verse 37. Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying? If he really cared, why didn't he do something? That's what the question is. It's the question we all want to ask in the face of grief and loss. We all have that question lurking there. Where is Jesus in my pain and trauma? And I believe that Lazarus stands as a window of hope for us about what Jesus will do for our loved ones on that grand day that's yet to come, when those who've fallen asleep in the Lord will rise and be with him. That's the promise of the Bible. And it's also to say to us in our suffering and pain that Jesus cares. Jesus cares immensely about our grief, our pain, and our suffering. But here's something you also need to know. Weeping isn't the only response of Jesus in this passage. In verse 33, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And here's what you need to know about that deeply moved expression. Nearly all of the commentators, this is not just one person thinking this, all of the commentators say that the emotion expressed here is anger. Anger. The word used for deeply moved is used outside of the Bible for the snorting of war horses. It's when they're pacing, ready for battle. This is something that rises above grief and is something quite separate. So it's worth taking note of. One commentator says, any attempt to interpret it in terms of internal emotional upset caused by grief, pain, or sympathy is illegitimate. This isn't grief now. This is another thing again. B.B. Warfield says, what John tells us in point of fact is that Jesus approached the grave of Lazarus in a state not of uncontrollable grief, but of inexpressible anger. Take that on board. That is worth pondering deeply. You see, Jesus is stirring for a fight with death as he approaches Lazarus' grave. And in verse 36, there's that expression once more. Jesus is deeply moved. Angry at death, once again. Remove the stone, verse 39. Martha expresses some horror at the indignity of the dead body in this state 4 days later. Jesus isn't going to be stopped on this mission. Nothing's going to stop him. Verse 40, did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? That's a pretty pointed thing to say to someone in grief. Do you believe? But it's the truth that challenges believers in this moment. Jesus can make a difference in your suffering and pain and loss. And Jesus did do something extraordinary that day to display God's glory, to open a crack on a window that gives us hope. This truth is universally available to all of God's people who believe. Do you believe? In the narrative, Jesus prays to his Father in heaven. He knows that the Father hears. He acknowledges that this prayer is more for the benefit of those around so that they'd see that Jesus, the Son, and God the Father are of single purpose in this moment that confronts death. And then, with a single sentence, he raises Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus, come out. And he does. I read a really interesting thing in a commentary this week. Some people have said, if he hadn't said Lazarus at the beginning of that sentence, all the world's graves would have been opened. I love that. One day. That will happen. Lazarus comes out. He's still bound in the wrappings around his body. From verse 45, we know that there were many witnesses. Many put their faith in Jesus. Many. This is no secret, hidden away event. Many saw and believed that day. There is good cause for hope. There is good cause for faith. But in the circles of the Jewish leaders, faith is not afoot. Word gets back to them. You would think that the power over death would be the ultimate trump card for faith. You'd think that, wouldn't you? Not so for the Sanhedrin. It meets, and their conclusion is to condemn Jesus' actions. In verse 48, their fear of the Romans is clearly heard. The Romans will come and take away their temple and their nation. That's what they're afraid of. That's what they hold on to. It's funny what you will hold on to instead of faith. There are many things to hold on to, and there are things to let go of in the middle of facing truth. The temple and the nation, they play second fiddle to the events of this day. There may be things that you hold on to that you need to let go of in the face of truth. In verse 50, Caiaphas says something cruel and dismissive of Jesus. And yet in verse 52, we're told that that's actually prophetic. That's an actual prophetic word that he says. He says, "You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." Well, that's exactly what Jesus is going to do. He's going to die for the benefit of all of God's people. It's prophetic, isn't it? Of course, Caiaphas doesn't mean it in that way. He just wants to see Jesus die. What they intend for evil, God intends for his great plans of salvation. You see, God sits in the middle of all that is occurring here. That's a reason for hope. His sovereignty remains unchanged. He has a plan. He has a good future ahead for his people. And he won't rest until he's achieved what he intends. After this, Jesus withdraws to Ephraim, verse 54. And the chief priests and the Pharisees are shown to be continuing to plot Jesus' death. And that's the passage. So where does it leave us? John writes, "So that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name." John 20, 31. He tells you the reason. So that we might have life. Life. In the face of death and all that we're talking about here. God's plans and purposes are towards the good of those who are called according to his purposes, so that you might have life in his name. And even in the painful arena of death and grief, all of the pain and associated trauma, God's glory and the good of his people will arise, even out of these painful circumstances. Jesus says to Martha in verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies." Death in this world isn't the end for God's people. A window of hope opened a crack so that we'd see, have a glimpse, have something to hold on to. That hope that we hold on to. It's enough for us to see that there's a universal plan that will transform the pain of this time into joy in another age. Bring on that age. But here's the thing. Lazarus died again. And you might ask me, how do I know that? Where's that in the passage? It's not written anywhere. It's just, I haven't seen him. Have you? He's just not around anymore. You see, Lazarus' resurrection isn't the ultimate resurrection that solves death as a problem for all time. There's something that still needs to happen, you know what it is, for that to come about. We'll see it when Jesus rises from the dead himself. You see, Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection to a life that never ends. Not Lazarus. Lazarus' resurrection gives us a glimpse. But Jesus will bring that reality to a more fuller, realized hope. So death, it doesn't bother Jesus in this passage like it does others. What bothers Jesus in this passage, and this is what you should take note of, is the pain and suffering that comes along with death. He weeps. He weeps at death. That should alert you to his great loving care for you in your suffering. And it's been my prayer that this is hope for anyone grieving currently, because you see it so clearly in this passage. But it's also found in the blueprints God's got for the new creation. Pain and suffering will no longer exist. The Bible could have defined the new creations in terms of life with no death, but I find it extraordinary how it does define it. It goes further. It takes the time to talk about what's absent. I find that really interesting. What's absent is pain, suffering, and all the things that make Jesus weep when he sees Mary and Martha in John 11. Let me read to you from Revelation 21. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes." Every tear. "There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." I'm nearly at the end, folks. I wish the pain wasn't here now. I wish that we didn't have to go through the pain and trauma of suffering. But this promise will have its end. And I hope that you've been instilled with the hope that's in this passage, arising from God's goodness and love. God is offended by death. It pains him to see pain and suffering. But he also was on the front foot to fight death for you. There is a promise for something better. We don't have to grieve without hope. As Paul says, we don't want you to grieve as those who have no hope. We have a sure and certain hope. Let me pray for you now. Heavenly Father, I thank you that we get a really good up close and personal view on who Jesus is in the face of death. We see raw emotions and responses that tell us an awful lot about how much he cares and is on the front foot in the face of death. And it's a horrible thing to face the loss of a loved one, or perhaps to face our own death in the near future. So hard, the loss that we see and perceive and feel, it goes so deep and it interrupts things in such terrible ways. So I thank you that Jesus shows us that he wept at the pain and suffering that it caused. But he also had another response that was on the front foot to address the problem of death for his people. I thank you that he put that boldly before Martha, that there is a hope. She just needs to hold on to it, to believe in who Jesus is and what he is able to do. I thank you that at the cross and in the resurrection, we see that hope cemented in place in wonderful ways for your people. And I pray, especially for any who are grieving or feeling lost today, that that hope would be so sure and true and near to them in this time. I pray this in your name and for your glory. Amen.